Chapter 32. High Society Murder. The woman's body lay at the foot of a flight of stairs. The angle at which the head was twisted made it clear that the neck was broken. Her name was Amy Robsart, and she was the 28-year-old wife of Robert Dudley, later the Earl of Leicester. It happened on September the 8th, 1560, and for the past four centuries historians have argued as to whether it was murder, and whether, if so, Queen Elizabeth I of England planned it. Robert Dudley, master of the Queen's horse, was tall and good-looking. His portraits make him look rather like Errol Flynn. When Elizabeth became Queen in 1558, they were both 25 years old. She fell in love with him, and her infatuation was so obvious that the country was alive with lewd rumours, such as the fact that she had borne one of his children. Whether or not the rumours were true, Elizabeth certainly considered marrying the courtier. However, he was already married to the daughter of Sir John Robsart, a wealthy Norfolk landowner. Since Dudley spent most of his time in London, and the Queen spent most of hers at home near Oxford, the sweethearts saw little of one another. Elizabeth apart, Dudley was not much liked. A Spanish envoy described him as the worst young fellow I've ever encountered. He is heartless, spiritless, treacherous and violent. On September the 4th, 1560, Queen Elizabeth told a foreign envoy that Amy Robsart was dead. The odd thing about this was that Amy was still alive and in the best of health. She died 4 days later. On the day of her death, she allowed the servants to attend a local fair and was alone in her home at Cumnor Place, Oxford. When the servants returned that evening, they found that a grave accident had taken place. The news was sent to Dudley, who was at Windsor, only 30 miles away. He might have been expected to rush straight home. Instead, he sent his cousin, with instructions to empanel a jury of discreet and substantial men to conduct an inquest. The actual evidence presented at the time has vanished, but the verdict was accidental death. If Elizabeth meant to marry her favourite, she had reckoned without the storm of rumour and suspicion that was inevitable after such a convenient happening. Public opinion against her was too strong. Dudley never became Prince Consort. In an attempt to discover evidence that the Queen was an accessory to murder, the historian J.A. Froude studied the letters of the Spanish ambassador in Madrid. It was he who discovered that the Queen had anticipated Amy's death. A year before that, the same ambassador was telling his king that Dudley planned to poison his wife. 7 years after Amy's death, her half-brother stated in an indiscreet moment that he had covered up the murder of his sister for the sake of Dudley. Questioned about this, he quickly withdrew his statement, merely saying that he had never been satisfied with the inquest verdict. Interestingly enough, Dudley had obtained an excellent sinecure for Amy's half-brother in 1564, 4 years after the accident. The historian A.L. Rouse states positively that Amy was dying of cancer when she fell downstairs. It is true that the Spanish ambassador states in another letter that Amy had cancer of the breast. This was 18 months before her death. But if she died of cancer, surely her husband would have taken care to make the verdict as public as possible. It would have been a perfect way of silencing all rumours. When all the evidence is weighed, it must be admitted that the balance of probability is in favour of the view that Robert Dudley had his wife murdered, with the connivance, or at least the knowledge, of Queen Elizabeth. Half a century after the death of Amy Robsart, England was rocked by the scandal of another death in high society. But on this occasion, the murderers were brought to justice, rather to the surprise of the British public. Elizabeth's successor, James I, was on the throne, an ungainly man who slobbered as he talked. He was also a homosexual. In 1606, the king was watching a tournament when a handsome young man fell off his horse and broke his leg. James immediately took a close interest in the invalid, whose name was Robert Carr. In fact, Carr had also had considerable homosexual experience. At the age of 11, he had been seduced by the poet and essayist Sir Thomas Overbury, whose Characters is a classic of English literature. Overbury had no objection at all when Carr became the king's lover. He had his own ambitions. He was appointed Carr's secretary, and within 2 years he was knighted. At this point, the tall and virile Carr fell in love with a teenage beauty, Frances Howard. Aged only 15, she was already married to the Earl of Essex, but he was abroad, and she was still a virgin. Since Carr was illiterate, Overbury did his wooing for him, writing his love letters. These were so effective that she soon yielded her virginity to Carr. Before long, her husband came home from abroad, but by then she was so infatuated with Carr that she refused to allow him his marital rights, even though they slept naked in the same bed. And finally, the Earl was persuaded to grant a divorce. For some perverse reason, her projected marriage to Carr filled Overbury with bitter jealousy. It seems possible that he and Carr were still lovers, and that the wedding would put an end to it. He quarrelled so violently with the young man that the king stepped in and offered Overbury a diplomatic post abroad. Carr, acting on the advice of Francis Howard, persuaded Overbury to refuse. As Carr expected, the king lost his temper and ordered Overbury to be thrown into the Tower of London to teach him manners. This was what Carr and his mistress wanted. Overbury was now at their mercy. Sir Gervase Elwes, a friend of Francis, was made governor of the Tower. Carr bought poison, and his manservant, Weston, administered it to the prisoner in small doses. On September the 15th, 1613, Overbury died. Carr and Francis Howard were then married, and Carr continued to be the king's favourite. His wife had the sense not to be jealous. But Carr was stupid, spoiled, and got into the habit of making scenes. Even the infatuated James began to tire of him. And then, 2 years later, the chemist's assistant, who had prepared the poison, died, but confessed to his awful crime on his deathbed. The king had to be told, and he appointed Sir Edward Cook to investigate the affair. As a result, Sir Gervase Elwes, who had known about the murder, the servant Weston, and the chemist who had supplied the poison, were all hanged at Tyburn. Carr was fairly certain that he would escape, convinced that the king was too fond of him to allow him even to be tried. When it became clear that he would be tried, together with Francis, he threatened to announce in open court that he and the king had been lovers for 10 years. The result was that when he appeared in Westminster Hall, two men stood behind him with a cloak, ready to throw it over his head if he tried to say anything against the king. Both Carr and his wife were sentenced to death, but the king kept his word that Carr should not be executed. The poisoners spent 6 years in the Tower of London, then were allowed to retire to their country estate. Francis Howard died of cancer of the womb at 39. Carr lived on into old age. When he visited the king a few years later, James broke down and cried on his shoulder. In general, the English have an excellent record for behaving impartially towards offenders from high society. A remarkable number of lords have stood trial on capital charges. In fact, one of them, Lord Moon, was tried for murder on two occasions. In December 1691, when he was 16 years old, he agreed to help one of his drinking companions, Captain Richard Hill, to kidnap a famous London beauty, the Drury Lane actress Mrs. Bracegirdle. She was actually Miss, but all actresses were given the courtesy title Mrs. The plan was to drag her into a coach as she left the theatre, and then to take her to a house where she could be safely raped. The actress's mother was with her, and clung on tightly, screaming until the watch came to help, whereupon Lord Moon, with admirable presence of mind, apologised for the disgraceful conduct of his unruly friend, begged everyone's pardon, and offered to escort the ladies home. They refused angrily, but Moon and Captain Hill followed them all the same, and began to make a disturbance in the street outside the house. They were still shouting and drinking wine from bottles, when an actor named Mountford had the misfortune to walk past on his way home. Hill was convinced that Mountford was Mrs. Bracegirdle's lover. His appearance on the scene seemed to confirm this. The captain drew his sword, and before Mountford could defend himself, ran him through. Hill then fled, and Moon was arrested. The nobleman was fortunate. Before Mountford died, he gasped out that Moon had offered him no violence. So when Moon was tried in front of a jury of his peers, the right of every English lord, he was only charged with maliciously abetting the murder. Moon's defence was that he was waiting outside Mrs. Bracegirdle's house to apologise to her. The peers believed him, and he was acquitted. Hill was never caught. 8 years later, however, Moon again stood at the bar of the House of Lords. There had been a wild party in London, ending in violent quarrels. Moon and two companions challenged three other men to a duel. All six went off to St. Martin's in the Fields, proceeded to fight, and a Captain Coote was mortally wounded. Once again, Moon was acquitted, but he was warned that if he didn't amend his ways, he could expect less leniency next time. To everyone's amazement, the notorious frequenter of brothels and taverns did just that, and for the next 12 years lived a blameless life, punctuated by a few brilliant speeches in the House of Lords. But in November 1712, his dark fatality caught up with him. He sued the Duke of Hamilton for debt, and the enraged Duke challenged him to fight. Moon, a superb swordsman, ran his opponent through, then lowered his guard and called on him to give up. The Duke rallied long enough for him to run his sword into 37-year-old Moon's stomach, whereupon both of them expired, so saving their peers the embarrassment of yet another trial. The last nobleman to be executed in England was Lawrence Lord Ferrers. Ferrers was a quarrelsome brute with a tendency to violence. On one occasion, when his horse had been beaten in a race, he thrashed his groom into unconsciousness. Another time, when a delivery of oysters was found to be bad, he ordered a servant to swear the barrel had been changed on the way. When the servant refused to perjure himself, Ferrers stabbed him in the breast, then smashed him into unconsciousness with a candlestick. After that, he kicked the poor servant in the groin so brutally that the man was lamed for life. At the age of 32, in 1752, Ferrers married, and then treated his wife with unremitting cruelty. He injured her seriously by kicking her senseless one day, and after 6 years of such behaviour, she understandably left him. Ferrers' steward, John Johnson, was then put in charge of the household. Pathologically suspicious, Ferrers soon became convinced that Johnson was plotting against him. 2 years later, in 1760, his insane suspicions came to a head. He sent for the steward and demanded to see the accounts. When Johnson produced them, Ferrers began to scream that they were falsified. The old man denied it. Ferrers ordered him to get on his knees and beg pardon. When the steward refused, he drew a pistol and shot him. Johnson collapsed and died a few hours later. The doctor who had attended the dying steward then summoned men to help him seize Ferrers. The nobleman tried to escape through the garden, but was captured. All the fight seemed to die out of him, and he was in a state of apathy when he was taken to the nearby Leicester Jail in Leicestershire. Doubtless he expected that his fellow peers would find reason for acquitting him of the capital charge, but his previous insane rages had made him widely detested, and he was sentenced to death. His execution at Tyburn on May the 5th, 1760, drew a record crowd. It was 5 years after the execution of Ferrers at Tyburn that Lord Byron, the great uncle of the poet Lord Byron, stood trial in the House of Lords on a murder charge. He had got into a quarrel with a friend, a Mr. Charworth, after a heavy drinking session in a tavern. Byron haughtily invited Charworth into the next room, drew his sword and ordered Charworth to defend himself. Charworth was killed after a few minutes fighting. The House of Lords obligingly found Byron guilty of manslaughter, which would probably have entailed a sentence of a few years. Byron, however, claimed benefit of clergy, an old law which ordained that a clergyman could only be tried by an ecclesiastical court, but later extended to anyone who could read and write, and he was allowed to go free. It's an interesting footnote to the affair that the poet Lord Byron fell in love with the great niece of the murdered Mr. Charworth, Mary Charworth, but she preferred to marry another man. In the United States, high society crime was a relative latecomer. If men of honour quarrelled, they fought duels, and no one thought of charging the winner with murder. It was not until the late 19th century, with the go-getters and robber barons, that there was a significant change in the pattern. It was the year 1872 that gave America its first chance to gloat over a real society murder. The killer was a gentleman. The victim most emphatically was not, which may explain why Jim Fisk was murdered in a public place rather than challenged to a duel. Fisk epitomised the American dream of the poor boy who made good. The son of a Vermont door-to-door peddler, he had perceived the flaws in his father's business methods by the time he was 14. His ideas about change and improvement soon put him on the way to being a rich young man. A Boston hardware store noted the quantity of goods the youngster ordered and asked him to come and work for them. Fisk was a wildly successful salesman, hearty, generous, expansive. During the Civil War, he unloaded vast stores of hardware on the army. After the war, he went to New York, met a robber baron called Daniel Drew, and, with another freebooter named Jay Gould, succeeded in stealing the Erie Railroad from Drew, one of the great piratical exploits of American commerce. New Yorkers loved Fisk's flamboyance, showmanship and extravagance, and they called him Jubilee Jim. He loved opera, so he bought the Grand Opera House, a typically grandiose gesture. He fell in love with Josie Mansfield, a plump beauty who decorated the fringe of the acting profession. Although married, Fisk built Josie a magnificent house in the heart of the theatre district and staffed it with an army of flunkies. Josie tended to get bored when her lover was out seeing to deals, but she consoled herself by trying to spend the money as fast as Jim made it. Then, one night, Fisk made the social mistake that was to cost him his life. He took his patrician friend, Ned Stokes, along to have supper with Josie. Stokes was a magnificently handsome man. Josie felt under no moral obligation to be faithful to Jim, since he kept several chorus girls in apartments. So, feeling no pangs of guilt or conscience, she and Ned became lovers. Sometime after this, the two men quarrelled. Stokes started a libel suit against Jubilee Jim because of certain intemperate expressions about their business deals that Jim had let fall to journalists. The newspapers were not slow to discover that Josie had deserted Fisk for Stokes, and the story was the delight of New York. Fisk countersued, alleging that Josie and Stokes were trying to blackmail him. On January the 6th, 1872, Stokes spent a trying morning in court, being roasted at the hands of Fisk's attorney. Eating lunch back at Delmonico's, he learned that the grand jury had indicted him for blackmail. In a fury, he rushed to his hotel to get a Colt revolver, then went to the Grand Central Hotel on Lower Broadway, where Fisk was going to pay a call that afternoon. Fisk arrived carrying a gold-headed cane and dressed in a red-lined military cloak and top hat. As he started to mount the stairs, Stokes stepped out from the head of the staircase and said, "I've got you at last." Fisk had time to shout, "Will anybody help me?" before he was shot down. He died with a bullet in his bowels. Stokes was tried for murder, but the jury disagreed. At a second trial, he was sentenced to hang. At a third trial, a technicality enabled him to escape with 6 years for manslaughter. He died a few years after his release from Sing Sing. Death in high society is always news, more so than in most other cases of violent or bloody happenings. In addition to the usual titillations of sex and brutality, there's the glamorous element of men and women, the slayers or the slain, who were either born high up on the social scale, or got there by means of their looks, personality or talent. It is a unique and infallible combination.